is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
They're going to make the plays. Our job as a coach is to direct them. It's to put them in the best situations on both sides of the ball and prepare them. But they have to react. They have to make those plays. They have to take that responsibility and accountability for it.
BJ Dunn is the head men's basketball coach at Gettysburg College in Pennsylvania. Dunn has led the Bullets to the postseason the past 2 years. Prior to Gettysburg, Dunn guided the Vassar College men's basketball program for 5 seasons. In his first season as head coach, Dunn became the youngest head coach of the NCAA at all levels at the time. And in 2016, he was one of 2 Division III coaches named to the Under Armour 30 Under 30 team. For his time at Vassar, Dunn spent a year as the men's basketball top assistant coach at Emerson College in 2011-2012 under Jim O'Brien, the former head coach at Ohio State University. He was also an assistant coach at Babson College during the 2010-2011 season. In addition to his work at the college level, Dunn was the founder, owner, and program director of the Bay State Flash AAU Basketball Club. Additionally, Dunn worked for the Boston Celtics NBA Development League affiliate, the Maine Red Claws, where he assisted the basketball operations department. Dunn is a 2010 graduate from Bates College with a Bachelor of Arts degree in sociology. He was a 3-year letter winner and served as a student assistant coach as a senior for the Bobcats. Hey, Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is John Wilkham, author of No Fear in the Arena, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Be prepared to take some notes as you listen to this episode with BJ Dunn, head men's basketball coach at Gettysburg College in the state of Pennsylvania. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight. And we are pleased to welcome BJ Dunn, the head men's basketball coach at Gettysburg College. BJ, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Hey, thanks, Mike. I'm excited to be here.
Thrilled to have you on. Looking forward to diving into all the things that you've been able to do in your career. Let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me a little bit about some of your first experiences with the game of basketball, what you remember from an early age.
Well, outside of my dad having to carry me out of the Fleet Center when the Indiana Pacers swept the Boston Celtics a long time ago, I guess for me, you know, my love started. I'm from a really small town in Massachusetts called Medfield. And some of my just earliest memories are being in our driveway before we had a basket. I used to put this milk crate in the driveway. And I don't know if you guys remember those like Lay's chips where you could accumulate points.
Oh, yeah. So
I remember I saved up enough points and I got one of those like really cool portable speakers. Now, my guys have no idea what those were because it was just the radio. Now, you know, we have all these unbelievable speakers that, project throughout the gym. But I remember I would like run out of my, garage into the driveway, and my grandparents had retired at the time to Wilmington, North Carolina. And my grandfather got me in North Carolina you know, full uniform. So that thing never got washed when I was like 8, 9 years old. I would, you know, shoot in this milk crate all the time. But that was really when I started to fall in love with it. And I played a lot of sports growing up, but, you know, I always just took to the teamwork and just the chemistry and, you know, I really just, you know, the excitement, you know, of the game. And, you know, that translated into continuing to play, obviously, throughout high school and then into college and into what I do now as a coach.
You were seriously old school with the milk crate, man.
Dude, old school, man. And it wasn't even like on a pole, man. Like I was shooting that thing on the ground. So, you know, I could really shoot the ball. So, like, you got to think.
You need a peach basket.
I had to.
DJ, you need a peach basket.
I know. I know. I needed that. But you want to talk about developing good arc, man. Like I had to have enough arc and touch so that ball didn't bounce out of the crate. Cause if it did,
exactly.
So that thing needed to land in there perfectly. And then, you know, obviously we finally got the hoop and, you know, we got the chain net. Cause if you have a hoop in the driveway, it has to have a chain net. So, that was when we moved to Gettysburg. That was my only request to my wife when she was like, what do you want to get for the house? I said, well, we're buying a house with a basket and I'm putting a chain net in day one. So that's what we have.
Nice. The aesthetics of the chain net.
Absolutely.
Got to hit that sound effect. There's no doubt. Get a different, best. It's a totally different feel than the swish. Let's put
nothing
it that way.
Better, man. Nothing better.
All right. So as you move on and you get a little bit older, what do you think about when you remember some of your early coaches? Are there guys that coached you, whether while you were playing in a youth league or when you're playing in middle school, that had an influence on you both as a player and maybe still now as a coach?
Yeah, no doubt. You know, one of the cooler things when I was in middle school, you know, I played lacrosse throughout middle school and high school. My dad was actually my middle school lacrosse coach from 6th to 8th grade. And I just, you know, we had such a really great relationship on the field and it was really fun, you know, just like being at practice, like with your dad, but knowing that like he was your coach and he was trying to help you get better. And I think when I think back on like my youth coaches, he definitely just, you know, sticks out to me where there was that, you know, give and take, that, you know, push pull relationship of, all right, like he's my dad, he wants to see me succeed and seeing him as a coach, but then also having an opportunity to, you know, see him as a dad too and watch him cheer and support you when you do something good. You know, and our teams were really successful. And I just like remember when I was in middle school, like he made it really fun, right? Like you're in middle school, it's not, you know, it was travel, but lacrosse was still new. So it wasn't these like elite select teams that there are now. And just the way that he was able to teach the game and make everybody really enjoy it for some of our players who may not be as athletic or understand the game at a level at some of the other guys, like he made them feel valued. And I've always carried that with me as a coach now at college of no matter what the talent level is going to be of the guys that I coach, I want everybody to feel valued. And I really got that from my dad. And you know, I was really lucky when I was in college, I played for two guys. I played for Joe Riley, who's now the head coach at Wesley. And I played for him for 2 years. And he just, you know, was such a culture guy. And I just remember like he was so stubborn on his values and standards. And we really believed in that too. And we had some really good teams my first 2 years in college. And then when he left for the Wesleyan job, John Furbush took over and he's had a lot of success. He took Bates to a Sweet 16 a couple of years ago. And I just remember his just like energy and passion and just competitive fire. And then, you know, when I graduated, I worked at Babson for Stephen Brennan, who won a national championship at Babson in 2017. And then I worked for Jim O'Brien, who was the head coach at Emerson at the time, but also the former head coach of Boston College and Ohio State. And both of those guys won the National Coach of the Year Award. So I've been really blessed that I've had an opportunity to be coached by my dad, to be coached by two incredible college coaches who have had a lot of success, and then to be mentored by two guys who you know, receive the, you know, the top award that you can as a coach.
When was the moment you knew you wanted to coach? Was that going back to the influence of your dad or did it come a little bit later?
So when I was a junior in college, going into that summer of my senior year, I thought I wanted to work in the front office. So I applied for all of these internship opportunities. I had an internship with the Charlotte Bobcats. I ended up staying up in Maine and working for the Maine Red Claws. And it was their inaugural year. And it was really cool because they hadn't hired a coaching staff yet. They hired like Austin Ainge, Danny Ainge's son, like a month into me being up there. But I spent a ton of time with our president every morning watching NBA Summer League games. And we were evaluating players, who was going to make rosters, who was going to slip. I did some research on some EuroLeague stuff, some lower level Europe leagues too, about, you know, which guys may want to try and test the NBA waters, who we could kind of get in the G League. And that was great. But I think it was at that moment, honestly, that I was like, man, like, these dudes are commodities. Like, this is a job. Like, we're talking about salaries and contracts and trading guys and who's going to slip and who's going to fall. And we're betting on these guys. And I really enjoy the camaraderie, the teamwork of like building something and really the process. And I think that's why we've had a lot of success since I've been at Gettysburg is, you know, we built it, you know, with younger guys and we've watched them grow and we've watched them develop. And I think it was that moment that I was like, man, like, I want to be on the floor. Like, I don't want to be, you know, an eye in the sky in some suite or some box and, you know, moving some guys around. I want to really develop relationships with guys. I want to help them through adversity and help them find other ways to win. I want to be in workouts. I want to diagram plays, scouts. So my senior year, I actually was a student assistant at Bates. And I think that was, but that moment, you know, that I was at the Red Claws really, you know, was the catalyst for, okay, like, I want to, you know, have a profession in basketball, but I want it to be on the floor.
So when you shift that mentality, then how did that shift your approach to the basketball landscape and starting to make connections and try to think about how you were going to actually get a job? Or was it still just, hey, I just got to build my network and kind of see where things fall?
Yeah, no, I was really fortunate. I had known Coach Brennan when I was at Babson. He had recruited me out of high school. His wife actually was my high school student advisor. I worked his camps. I went to his summer camps. So going into that summer, all I knew what I was going to do was I was going to get my master's from Boston College. I figured that would be a good thing to have. I just finished undergrad. I was like, all right, I'm already in an academic mindset. I might as well keep this thing going and not take a break. And I went into his office just asking for help and advice. And he said, hey, I got an open spot. What do you think? And I'll never forget that. And I've always tried to do the same. I had such an unbelievable undergraduate experience for my coaches. And then for him, you know, who knew me, but obviously didn't know me as a coach, but he was willing to put his, you know, stamp of my approval of being on his staff. That just meant so much to me. And I'm forever, you know, grateful for him that anytime someone wants to get their foot in the door and reach out for advice, if I have an opening, I'm going to do whatever I can to help them out and mentor them. And, that's really how I got in. And then I connected with Coach O'Brien through somebody that Coach Brennan knew. I started my own AAU program when I graduated from college. I did that for 2 years. Obviously, I built up my network that way, having some college level guys, and you're talking to college coaches on the phone and you're out and you're about. And I think it's important to try and be everywhere as a young coach. Like, you got to grind, you got to hustle. I know people don't always talk about, they don't like to, talk about the word grind, but it is a grind. I mean, you're working almost 7 days a week. You're in the gym Friday, Saturday, Sunday. You don't see a lot of sunlight. So it is a grind in a lot of ways. And, I felt like that kind of helped me, grow and expand my network and put myself out there as someone that, you know, was going to be a relentless worker and had a strong passion for the game.
All right. Best part and worst part of running your own AAU program?
Oh my God, man. Well, the best part was it was when AAU was AAU when I was doing it. So we used to, that was when like Super Showcase and Nationals were in Orlando and everybody would go. So to me, that was the best. You knew where you're going for 2 weeks. It was so much fun, being down there and being in the ESPN, or the Disney, arenas. Oh man, the worst part, honestly, is just like getting the kids to practice, man. I did a lot of driving, and back then I didn't have a lot of money in my bank account. So any money that I had, I was spending on gas money, picking kids up and taking them places.
That's funny. And that, which obviously is still going on many, many times over today, without question.
Yeah, AAU it's an interesting world. We can maybe talk about that a little bit when we talk about your recruiting when we get to that point in the pod. Tell me a little bit about how what that first experience was like at Babson in terms of, did it live up to your expectations? Was it what you thought it was going to be? Was there something different maybe that you were surprised about that, hey, I didn't realize that college assistant coaches did all of this stuff? Or just what was your first experience like?
Yeah, you know, I remember when when I was at Bates and being a student assistant, you know, when I had talked to, you know, Coach Furbush, you know, I said, listen, if I'm going to do this, like, I want to be all in. Like, I want to be treated as an assistant. I want to be involved in, you know, game planning. I was like, I'm a student. You don't need to take some of my ideas, but I want to be there. I want to be part of it. I want to see everything that had gone in. So I had a year under my belt of understanding practice planning, scouting reports, strategy, game planning, some of the recruiting. You know, I think the biggest thing for me was, I mean, you know, as you know, you're enjoying your senior year, like on the weekends, I was at school. I'm not in the gym recruiting. I think that was probably like where some of your friends are out having a good time or they're on summer vacation. Like, hey, where are you going? I'm like, I don't know, somewhere in New Hampshire, you know, on a Friday night to watch the New Hampshire Jayhawks and, you know, AAU showcase tonight. So I just think the amount of time that we spend in the gym and spend on a player to really build a necessary relationship to yield them, I think was something that was really eye-opening to me that I've always carried now, you know, with me wherever I go and how we really attack recruiting. But I think just Coach Brennan was so detailed oriented in everything that we did, you know, whether it was slobs or blobs, you know, how we were playing post, you know, defense, everything was just so detailed oriented. And again, I think, you know, that's something that I've taken from him. And, you know, we break our program down. I think our guys will tell you that, you know, everything, you know, has a lot of details to it because that's how you're going to win, you know, a basketball game.
Did you start putting together a notebook, a computer file of all the things that you felt like you needed to continue to remember and just gather as you thought, started to prepare for the potential that maybe someday you'd be a head coach?
So you're going to laugh. I'm in my office basement right now. Next to me is this massive binder called BJ Dunn's Book of Basketball with this horrible Photoshop of this rubber basketball.
Nice.
It's probably word art, if anybody remembers what that was. But
oh, yeah.
It just has every tab from personal to how I would recruit, what I would want my guys to wear on the road or in the locker room, to fundraising ideas, to locker room quotes. And I would just compile it everywhere I go. And, you know, I actually still do it now. One of the best actually purchases that I've ever made for myself was called the Remarkable 2. It's a tablet that's a note taker. So I used to have all these different binders, all these notepads. I've consolidated them. And then all my assistants, you know, they give me a lot of grief because we have this Google Drive that literally has a tab for any, you name it, we have a tab for it, or a folder for it. But I think you have to start compiling that. You have to have an idea of how you want to play. I think you have to be doing that years in advance before you get that opportunity because, you know, when you're in that interview, you have to speak it into existence and the committee has to be like, okay, this guy has done this before. You know, he's talking like he's run a program before. He has a true belief and vision for how he's going to run so-and-so college men's basketball team. So, you know, once I was a student assistant at Bates, I started doing it and I just carried it all the way through. I've always been a note taker. I'm definitely not the smartest person in the room ever. And I just try and ask a lot of questions and soak up a lot of answers if I can.
When did you feel like you were ready to start interviewing? Do you remember your first interview and just what sort of pushed you over the edge to say, hey, I'm ready for that opportunity?
You know, so I was really lucky. I was in the right place at the right time. So when I was at Vassar, I was an assistant at Vassar College. There was unfortunately a coaching change. I remember I was in Charlotte, North Carolina. I was working an academic basketball camp for Harvey Rubin and Lane Odom. We were at Davidson Day. I was at lunch with a couple of my college, you know, a couple of guys working camp. I had interviewed for a couple of assistant jobs. I actually was about to accept an assistant coaching job in the NESCAC, and the AD at Vassar called and was like, hey, listen, like HR can't pull their stuff together. We're not going to be able to run a search in time to make this competitive. how would you feel about being the interim coach for a year? I'm 25 years old at the time, and it was about to double my salary. So I was like, hell yeah. I was, but I think, you know, so much of coaching is just luck. And, you know, I was like, okay, I'm willing to bet on myself. I've always been willing to bet on myself my whole life. And I knew nothing was guaranteed after the first year. I knew I was taking over a program that had been in two conference tournaments in its 42 years of existence and had won 31 games in 5 years and was returning all the players from a team that won 6 games the year before. But I was willing to bet on myself. And so I didn't really have to interview. But I guess in a lot of ways, that season was a year-long interview. And how I was going to approach the day-to-day as a 25-year-old, where, you know, my seniors were 22, and, you know, there wasn't that much, you know, age gap between me and them. We won 19 games that year. We set a program record for wins in a season and conference wins in a season. We lost in double overtime in the conference championship game. I could probably tell you everything that happened in that game still. Yeah, I think that was the interview. So, you know, I think a lot of people always prepare for, you know, that Zoom or that on-campus interview, but you're interviewing every single day when you're in the department, when you're on campus, when you're in the community. Everybody is always watching you. I've always had that mindset. I've always wanted to, you know, attack my days, you know, with a lot of passion, energy, enthusiasm, and try and make everybody around me better. And we ask that of our guys too. So I think when you talk about that interview process, I think it's really important for, you know, young guys who are eager to become a head coach that you are interviewing now, whether you know it or not. And, you know, the more that you can act and prepare like a head coach now, you're going to be more than ready when that, you know, phone call comes your way.
So when you get that opportunity, you're transitioning from being an assistant in the program to being a head coach, which obviously quite clearly shifts your role and shifts your relationship with the players. And you're doing that as a first-time head coach at age 25. What was that transition like for you in terms of just changing your role and the way that the players looked at you? How'd you handle that?
You know, I've always been someone who's been relationship driven, you know, try to build trust and have connection with guys. And that's never changed from when I was assistant to a head coach. I think obviously there's going to be, you know, some boundaries, but I've always wanted my guys to feel comfortable being able to share things with me, that aren't just, you know, going on the court. I think that's really important. You know, I think one of the biggest things that, you know, I really tried to do was, you know, as that assistant coach, you know, you're liked, everybody really likes you, right? Like you're their sounding board. You know, a lot of times you're younger, so you're close in age. I try to really transition that from being liked to being respected. And I think gaining that respect through vulnerability, of being able to talk about my career, what I have going on off the court, what's going on in my life, who I am as a person. And I've continued to try and do that because I think sometimes we often look at ourselves as coaches and these guys are your players, but we're so much more than that. You know, we're people. I'm a husband, I'm a father, I'm a son, I'm a brother, I'm a friend, I'm a colleague. We wear a lot of hats. We have a lot of layers to us, as do our players. So I think that transition for me was really more about, all right, I got to open up. I got to let these guys really know who I am if they're going to really follow and believe my vision and what I'm trying to do. And, you know, I think that really helped us and it, you know, it led to a really successful first season.
Looking back, how solid were you with the way you wanted to play, your philosophy, all the things that you talked about that you had put into your notebook? Once you had to put those things in practice, how much did you stick to the script versus kind of saying, ooh, maybe it didn't play out exactly the way that I thought it would and having to make adjustments on the fly?
Yeah, you know, we, you know, that first year we really stuck to the script pretty good. You know, we were kind of a Princeton two-guard team. We played a kind of a slow, methodical pace. We weren't very deep. We had to limit possessions, which made us pretty good defensively. You know, I had some really bright guys. I mean, Vassar was a top 10 academic school in the country and still is. So we could really throw a lot at them. We could take away a lot of different actions and looks, which helped us, especially if you're limiting possessions. It's limiting the amount of time that, you know, your guys actually have to be, you know, on that side of the ball. And I thought we had the right personnel to play to that. You know, we had a really strong point guard who could really, you know, shoot it. And we had a great wing who averaged 20 a game as a sophomore, and we could put those guys in a lot of rub actions together. And you got to choose because both of them could really shoot it. So oftentimes somebody was open if we could really, you know, slip it or reject a screen hard. But as the season kind of went on, we had a forward who was starting to come on really strong, and we had to find ways to be able to play two forwards together. So, you know, that changed my philosophies a little bit with some of the Princeton stuff where you're kind of four around one and, you know, trying to find a way to get, you know, two bigs on the floor. And if they're going to be in some of the rub actions, having them curl or reject or slip it to try and get a post up and try and get a high low from the pinch post. And then defensively, you know, I've always been a pack line guy. I've evolved as I've kind of moved, gotten to Gettysburg. We're a little more aggressive. I think that's because of, you know, how we've recruited. And then, you know, unfortunately, every other year at Vassar, we had some, you know, challenging injuries, like serious injuries to some key guys, season ending. So I couldn't always be super stuck in my ways. We had to be a little more creative with how we played. So we had to experiment with some funky zones to try and change things up, try and steal a couple games that way. So, you know, I think you have to be able to adapt. You have to be kind of creative and innovative with some of that stuff. But, you know, I think as long as your standards and what you expect out of your guys every day doesn't change, I think you can kind of tweak a little bit your X's and O's because they're going to have to as the personnel changes.
Where'd you go and where do you continue to go when you want to learn? Are you going to mentors? Are you going to film work? Are you going to leadership books? I'm sure it's a little bit of everything, but just talk a little bit about your learning process as a coach.
Yeah. So I'm a big reader. I love to read. I have a binder of all the books that I've read. I type up all of the notes that I take in the books. You know, one of the, you know, I love the EuroLeague. I love European basketball. I'm really fascinated by it. I think I've always been just impressed. I think European coaches are a little more, they're more risk takers than I think we are in college. The NBA is getting there too, where I think they do some things where people would kind of be like, oh, why are they doing that? Why would they turn their back to the ball on a weak side helped, you know, to take away the one more, right? Or, you know, why would you try and force the ball back to the middle instead of allow the ball to go to the corner and keep it on one side of the floor? So I've always been intrigued by that. And Slapping Glass does such an unbelievable job with their
news. Those guys are awesome.
Videos and breakdowns. And I was able to do a round table with them at Van Gundy last year. And so that's really where I go. They do a lot of that stuff, but there's a lot of other guys on Twitter that I really enjoy and follow. But yeah, it's just, I think the reading, you know, read as much as you can. We do summer reading with our guys. And when we come back in the fall, you know, we always have some culture meetings based around the book. We read Legacy by James Kerr about the All Blacks in New Zealand. So, you know, I think just, you know, as much as I can get my hands on, and then every off season, I try and come up with some type of plan of, all right, you know, I have all these Twitter bookmarks of offensive ideas. All right, let me look through these. All right, this week I'm going to look through some defensive stuff, and, you know, not trying to like completely change what you do, but just like adding a couple things here and there. You know, it's funny, like, you know, my wife the other day was like, hey, like, now that, you know, classes are over, like, do you have to be in the office every day? And I was like, but I like to be in it. I like to, you know, watch, you know, as much basketball as I can. This is the fun part of the year for me where I really get to learn and grow and think about where we can put some of our personnel and put them in positions to succeed. So I think that's really crucial for anybody in our profession to never stop learning.
Yeah, absolutely. I think being able to learn and then, like you mentioned earlier, being then able to look at your personnel and adjust, whether that's adjust in the off season going into the year with the anticipation of which guys you're going to have available. And then obviously in some situations, if you have injury or other things that happen where you've got to adjust on the fly. And the more tools you have in your bag, the better off you're going to be able to make those kinds of adjustments. What about the recruiting when you're at Vassar? Obviously, as you mentioned, tremendous academic school. What was it like recruiting there? What did you like about that process and some of the guys that you were able to bring in?
Yeah, no, it was, it was definitely challenging, but I think in a good way. There was a really, high academic standard that you had to meet to be accepted to Vassar, as there should be. I think that really helped me just with my networking, expanding my network to, a national level of, all right, we're not just going to recruit kids, in New England or in New York. Like, we have to really get out there if this is such a small pool of potential, student athletes. So I think that really just opened that network up for me, allowed me to connect with a lot of different high school prep coaches, AAU coaches. And we were able to get involved with some really, really great players who, are doing some pretty amazing things in the real world. We actually, have our first wedding, player wedding this fall in the Outer Banks, which is going to be pretty exciting and really cool. Just to see those guys go through different life stages. Which we're excited about. So, I think, that's the biggest thing that I would say that I took away from that experience was, really, working with the high school and the AAU coaches, prep school coaches, and having a more national network, than, starting some, having a regional job where you're only very, recruiting from a regional standpoint.
So you spend 5 years at Vassar, and obviously you're getting that thing turned around from where it was when you took over. Great institution, and you've got the program headed in the right direction. Why Gettysburg? Why at that moment? What about the opportunity there was attractive to you? And just tell me a little bit about the process of getting there.
Yeah, no doubt. So, I think a couple of things, I was really proud of what we're able to do at Vassar. It definitely took a lot of energy to get that to where we had to go. And I felt like I probably got it as far as I was going to be able to get it. And I felt like it probably needed somebody else. And Ryan Mee's done a phenomenal job. I mean, they won the Liberty League championship for the first time ever a year ago. And he's going to continue to do great things there. And that's a really good friend of mine. But it was going to take a job like Gettysburg for me to apply to look elsewhere. So my wife is a Gettysburg alum. She was an All-American lacrosse player at Gettysburg. So when that job, opened up, there was a lot of pressure on me.
the most important pressure right there.
Important pressure. But, I think when we both thought about the job, we were just married. It was an opportunity to kind of come home and start a home and start a family in a lot of ways. In an area that she was familiar in, a place that she loved and that I had grown to love because of the people that I had met through her that, just talked about Gettysburg like it was one of the eighth wonders of the world. And it's a pretty amazingly strong, passionate place. And it was a place that I felt like we could win a national championship. And when you look at the success of our athletic teams across the board, we've won well over 100 Centennial Conference championships. A lot of our teams have been super successful. Our women's lacrosse team just lost the national championship. Our men's lacrosse team went to the Sweet 16. Our women's basketball team went to the NCAA tournament again. Our men's and women's soccer teams have been successful. I just felt like this was a place for me and the desires that I had as a coach. It wasn't going to compromise the academic piece. It was still a top 50, liberal arts institution that believes in student athletes, believes in what the power and the value of athletics. And that was incredibly enticing. And then, you add on the fact that there's this amazing support from the top where we have connection with the president almost every day. We have connection with the vice president, admissions and financial aid and, marketing and communications. The rest of campus really believes in what we're trying to do. It's just a home run and an absolute fit for me and my family.
What was the number one question you asked in the interview when you were thinking about what was going to make the difference and whether or not you were going to go there?
Man, that's a great question. I feel like I might have blacked out that day because I was so nervous. I think, you know, I remember being in the room. It was intimidating. There was all staff was in the interview. Like, I'm talking every staff member at the college. I mean, there must have been 40 people packed in this conference room. And, you know, I was like, man, how could I kill some time? These people don't grill me. Let me ask each and every single one of them a question. So, you know, I asked them to go around and tell me why Gettysburg, like what makes this place so special. And everybody talked about the people. Everybody talked about the people. And I remember when I got hired, everybody wanted to talk to me. Everybody wanted to get to know me. And that hasn't changed in my 5 years being there. And I think that says a lot about that place, that, you know, students come up to you and they say hello and they have conversations with you. And, you know, you have faculty and staff. They talk about your guys. Like, there's not a lot of liberal arts colleges that are that connected with athletics and academics, right? And then, you know, obviously I wanted to know, like, what the vision was. Like, you know, do we want to win and compete on a national level? Because that's our goal. I mean, we're chasing two giants. I mean, Swarthmore and Johns Hopkins are both top 10 in the country. I mean, they're, you know, Landry and Josh are two of the best coaches in the country at any level. And that's who we're chasing. And if, you know, we want to catch them, like, we have to have that type of support. And they were all in on that. And, you know, I've been, you know, really, you know, grateful since being hired.
So the first thing, obviously, that you have to do if you want to reach that goal of contending on a national level is you got to get the right players in place. When you first get the job, you're clearly inheriting a roster, and then you're putting your recruiting classes together as you go forward. Tell me a little bit about your recruiting philosophy and then your process, how you go from, hey, let's identify guys that we want to put on our radar, and then just how do you go through evaluating those players and eventually figuring out who makes it onto campus and becomes a part of your roster?
No doubt. So, yeah, I think the first thing for us, you know, we looked at Swarthmore Hopkins, and, you know, the first thing I said is we're never going to be Swarthmore Hopkins, and I don't want us to be them. I mean, they're them because of who they are, and they're incredibly well coached. They're incredible academic institutions, and they've been super successful. We have to be different in the league. Everybody in the league is playing a certain style. We have to be a little different. We have to get bigger. We have to be more athletic. You know, we have to be able to really guard, because that's what it's going to take to beat those guys. So, you know, we went out and we tried to find guys with high motor guys. I think high motor guys are going to have a competitive fire about them. They're going to be incredibly passionate. They're going to be guys that are going to be winners on and off the court. We wanted guys with a lot of length. We wanted to be able to switch 1 through 4. So we had to find some guys who had length that we weren't allowing any type of advantage, you know, for our opponent when we would switch. And then, you know, we wanted guys who were winning. And I think that's easier said than done, right? To, like, you know, make sure everything fits. But, you know, in that first class, man, we were so lucky. We got Ryan McEwen from the Sanford School. This kid is the most influential recruit I think I'll ever get, you know, in my career. He is just absolutely, you know, incredible. I mean, he knows our schedule in and out. I'm not talking the game schedule. I'm talking our daily schedule. When we break it down, he lets everybody know where they're supposed to be. He's involved in the community. He also has led the league in block shots the past 2 years and has been top 25 in the country in block shots too. So the kid can hoop. But he won state championships at the Sanford School. We got this kid, Elijah Williams from Sidwell Friends, who won a state championship at Sidwell Friends. You know, another player on our leadership team this year was a sophomore, Carl Schallers from Garnet Valley. Garnet Valley had the best season in program history his senior year when he was the MVP of the league. So those are the type of guys that we're looking for that have experience winning, because we knew that we had to flip this thing. You know, we took over a program that had five winning seasons in 7 years, you know, and had won 7 games, you know, the year before. And, you know, we needed to bring in players who understood the type of work that it was going to take to turn this thing around. And those are the guys that, you know, we've been really fortunate to yield and go after. I mean, our freshman class this year, you know, all had a lot of success in high school. We're not just talking about individual success. You know, we really focus more on the team team success. And those are the guys that we knew were going to be coachable and help us. So, you know, once we kind of had that idea, those are the guys that we honed in on. And I think Gettysburg's a place, you know, I think it's a first choice from an academic and athletic place. When people come and see our facilities and get a campus vibe, it's a place that they want to go. And I think it's helped us, you know, expedite the growth process and be involved with some higher level guys because of those things.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more. How do you balance evaluating a kid with their high school team versus AAU? Do you weigh one more than the other? Do you like looking at them in both environments and kind of taking bits and pieces from each one? How do you look at just seeing those players in those two contrasting environments?
Yeah, no, I would agree with what you just said, that, you know, we're kind of taking bits and pieces from both. What's been great is having these scholastic periods in June. You know, it's, you know, it gives us an opportunity to evaluate these guys in AAU from April, right, all the way up until those in June. And then they play with their high school teams, and just to kind of see how they fit in and gel. You know, what was actually great about COVID when we didn't play and high schools did, you know, we got to watch almost every one of those games because everything was live streamed. And that was
right,
honestly, yeah, like one of our better recruiting classes that we've ever had. And, you know, we really enjoyed watching those guys compete because there wasn't a lot of guys in the gym. And you could tell, you know, when the gym wasn't full, you didn't have those student sections, right? Everybody's playing in masks. Like, you got a really good feel for who loves this game, regardless of how many people are in the stands and if the music is pumping, right? And I think, you know, watching all those games and seeing who could get up game in and game out when there weren't fans, that, you know, those guys have, you know, really helped us at Gettysburg.
Once you have these guys on campus and you're starting to build your team, obviously one of the things that's really important is creating a cohesive team and building the culture. When you think about what it takes from your end as a head coach to build a culture, what are some of the keys to making sure that you're building the kind of team that you want to coach?
So, you know, when we're in the recruiting process, we talk a lot about pounding the rock. That's kind of become our mantra. It's this idea of this relentless pursuit of continuous improvement and just trying to get better every single day. So I think in the recruiting process early, we're really trying to vet the type of guys that are gym rats, that are want to be coached, that know they're not a finished product. And we really stress, you know, the idea of this is what our goals are every single day. And when you step in our facility and when you put on this jersey and when you're part of this team, this is what we're going to ask of you every single day. And that's kind of our culture. So it's all about putting the team first. I think we're very clear with guys up front in the recruiting process that you're going to be on a roster with a lot of other talented players that were all league, that could have been 1,000-point scorers, probably were. But in order for us to go where we all want to go, we're going to have to check egos. We're going to have to give ourselves up for the betterment of the team. We talk a lot about beating yesterday, you know, pound the rock mantra and how important that is. We ask guys to bring the juice every day. And for us, the juice is jacked up, intense, contagious energy. And we try and get that out of guys in the recruiting process, whether that's on Zoom, a phone call, they're on our campus. But we want to know, like, who has a lot of passion, intensity, enthusiasm. And then we really want to find guys who love to compete at everything that they do. You know, whether it's ping pong, whether it's walking to, you know, the dining hall, it's in the classroom, it's video games. You know, I think that's really been a change in our culture. Is we don't talk a lot about winning and losing. Now there's a score. We keep score for everything, but we don't talk a lot about it because we want our guys to give themselves up to the game and to not fear making a mistake because it's either going to cost them a game or they could potentially, you know, game winning shot. They're a little tight if it doesn't go in, but no, man, you took that shot. Like you gave yourself up. You competed. That was really important. And then we always talk about like, just do what we do. Like, don't compare. We compete. We don't compare. And the other key with our competing is we want guys who can embrace adversity and find ways to win anyways. And we try and get that out in the recruiting process too. Like, has there been some adversity in high school, in a game, in a season? Just kind of getting an idea of where they are mentally. And then, you know, our last two are just making every play count is crucial for us and everything that our guys do, being a good citizen off the court. And then we want guys to appreciate the journey. It's incredibly hard to put on a basketball jersey. When our guys get there, we ask them to have a lot of gratitude for all of the people that have poured into them and who are going to continue to pour into them. So I think by sharing those things early on in the recruiting process, I think our guys get a really great idea of what they're about to walk into. And then, you know, when they get to us, I think one of the other, you know, strong things that we do is I'm a big believer that everybody on our team has to be an elite leader. It's not just about our upperclassmen, our captains. When our freshmen come in, they're going to have the same weight and responsibility to the mission as a senior who's played in 70 games. I think that increases our connection. It enhances the brotherhood and makes guys feel pretty invested in what we're trying to accomplish.
All right, let's talk about the competitiveness and the leadership piece. Let's go competitiveness first. Obviously, the initial part of that is you're going to recruit competitive guys. So you're trying to get a feel for them before you even bring them onto the team. But when you talk about developing competitiveness within your team, let's say just in a practice setting, besides you mentioned keeping track and keeping score when you're doing drills and the things that you're doing during practice, what in your mind is important to develop a competitive practice model if we're talking about some advice you might have for other coaches if they want their practices to be more competitive?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important for the guys to understand that they only control the effort and their effort's going to control the results. So I think, you know, we're pretty clear with our guys right away that like they're in control of that. You know, I think anytime you can increase some just like intensity and enthusiasm in the practice, you know, we're going to be a high energy staff. We're going to bring it. We're going to expect our guys to bring it too. You know, I think the way that our practices flow and the way we model our practices just create that competitiveness. I think our guys know what to expect every single day. So when they get into the gym, you know, we're going to hit a quick dynamic warm up. And then, you know, actually before that this year, we started doing offensive skeleton, which was something new that I've never done in practice before our guys even stretched. And the reason being was I wanted our guys to get into a basketball mindset before the dynamic. Because I think sometimes the dynamic guys can goof around. They talk about their day. So before that even happened, like we're doing skeleton, we're running through stuff, maybe we're installing. And that was really good for us. And I think we had really great practices this year because we didn't waste like that time at the beginning of practice where we were sloppy. Like our guys had to execute. They had to be on. They had to be connected. And then we always are doing some type of footwork, you know, there's time on the clock. You know, we're talking about very detailed, specific stuff with our feet, where our hands are on the catch, how we're stepping and attacking in a closeout downhill. But I think our guys have a really good feel for the flow. We always have shooting competitions. We keep track of all shooting records. So our guys know what the records are. I think that creates a really fun, joy, competitive environment when our guys are trying to break a record and they know with a minute left, all we need to do is make 10 more shots. And I think that puts so much more emphasis on the process that needs to get there for that shot. And then the way just like we have practices with, you know, we have two teams or we have three teams. We play a lot of cutthroat. I think that's been really good for us. It gets everybody involved. We don't have a lot of guys standing around. Everybody kind of feels engaged in practice and has an opportunity. And then, you know, I think the biggest way, I should have said this at the beginning, is we really believe in hustle stats. So for the first month of our season, we have 30 different categories for both sides of the ball that we feel like impacts winning. And we tell our guys, hey, these next, you know, two or three segments, so it's 30 minutes or whatever, every practice is going to be hustle statted. So, you know, our managers are tracking, you know, possessions. Everybody has to play an equal amount of possessions. That's the only way to develop a fair player efficiency rating. And then after practice, I'll take the offense. My assistant will take the defense. So there's no like crossover bias. We watch the same thing. And then we chart those categories. And then every day it spits out a player efficiency rating. So I think that really creates a lot of competition in the first month because – excuse me. It's a meritocracy. Everybody feels like they have an opportunity to really get into the depth chart.
All right. How do you train your managers to make sure that they're getting things recorded the way that you want them recorded? And then I'm assuming you go back and are kind of double checking at least at first until you start to build up some trust with those guys.
Now, our managers, we have the best managers in the country. One of them is the GA at Buffalo. The other is the GA at the Mount. And another is an assistant coach in the Millbrook School in New York. So we kind of crushed it with those three guys this past year, and they're going to be pretty missed. But those guys were absolutely awesome. So, you know, we've been doing it. They've been with us for the past couple of years. So they kind of had an idea. We just had a sheet. They knew anytime somebody crossed half court, it was a possession. And then, you know, because it's going to be in a very specific part of practice, we actually like will make those sheets based on the teams and possible rotations that are going to be seen in that segment, if that makes sense.
No, it does. I mean, I think that's one of the things that when you start talking about, again, it's different at the Division I level where you got so many guys on staff at the Division III level. It's sometimes, I think, more difficult, right, to be able to track the things that you might want to track. And I know we've talked to a lot of coaches that sometimes they'll go back and when they're watching the film of practice, they'll kind of chart things themselves or just have them, their assistant do it. And so for you to be able to have managers that you could sort of hand off that task and then be able to come back and have those things at your fingertips, I'm sure was tremendously valuable. How much time do you spend after a practice evaluating that practice before you move on to the next one?
Every morning we're breaking that practice down and watching it. You know, we have a, you know, Synergy key motion camera. So we're able to film every practice. That's been really helpful to be able to also just get guys in the office and to watch practice film too. So, you know, it's probably an hour to 2 hours to break down that like 30 minutes of the live play. But it's really, you know, been huge for us.
Absolutely. All right. Talk a little bit about the leadership piece. You mentioned how you want everybody to be able to lead in your program. And I think one of the things that is always a challenge. You hear coaches say all the time, hey, we want to develop leaders in our program. We want more leadership. And I think what's important is how do you go about giving the players the space to be able to lead? So when you think about developing each player on your team into a leader, or you just think in general about developing leaders in your program, what are some ways that you do that in terms of giving them the opportunity to take something over and lead, if that question makes any sense?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, you know, going back to what you were saying is, you know, coaches always talk about wanting to develop leaders or everybody to build leaders. And you know, I think it, you know, we have to look at is how do we define leadership? Because there's so many different ways to define leadership and what a leader looks like, right? I think you have, you know, everybody in their mind has that quintessential, like that loud, energetic, giving the rah-rah speech. But, you know, we had one of the best leaders I've ever coached this year who probably didn't say much for 4 years. But the kid showed up every single day and he never really played a lot of minutes for us. But every single day he showed up with the same type of commitment and intensity like he was playing in game 7 of the NBA Finals. Like he took care of his body. He foam rolled. He Theragunned. He dynamic warm up. He had the same shooting routine. Like that's leadership to me, right? And then when you can balance that with some guys who can get fiery and give that speech and hold some guys accountable. But I think being able to show up every day and hold your own self accountable is a leadership that we're trying to get out of our guys. And I think when our guys understand that the onus is placed on them, that, you know, they're going to make the plays. Our job as a coach is to herd them. It's to direct them. It's to put them in the best situations on both sides of the ball and prepare them. But they have to react. They have to make those plays. They have to take that responsibility and accountability for it. And obviously, we spend a lot of time teaching that and preparing it. But in the flow of the game, I think that's important. I think one of the things too that, you know, if you ever watch this practice, I don't start and stop it a lot. A lot of what I do and I ask our staff to do is I want them to live coach, because that's what we have to do in a game. We can't start and stop it a lot. And our guys can't take in a ton of information. There's so many studies out there that show, like, if you try and, you know, give your guys like four things in a minute, they're probably only going to remember one. So what is that most important thing? And we try and stick to that. So every day in our practice plan, you know, we have each coach is coaching an area, and how that leads into leaders is our guys have to figure it out on their own. The knowledge has to be on the floor. It's great if our staff knows what the other team is going to do, or we know how we want to attack some type of ball screen, but our guys have to be able to execute that. So we start that in practice. And when they can, you know, build those connections and that those leadership and those voices and those actions together, man, that's when the magic happens. And it's really awesome to see. You know, I think some of our other leadership stuff that we've done, I think the, you know, the summer reading is great. We split guys into groups. They each take like 2 to 3 chapters and they give these presentations, and they continue to blow me away when they do these presentations. Like, you know, they have these unbelievable PowerPoints and they really spend a lot of time and energy and effort into it. And it's really impressive. But I think giving them and letting them know that they have as much stake in this program as you, I think is really, really important. You know, I don't know if you guys watch Ted Lasso, but it was, you know, incredible TV show. And, you know, one of the last scenes, you know, this guy, Trent Karim, was writing this book and he called it The Last Away. And he said, change it. This was never about me. It was always about the program and the guys. And I think that's a really important way to look at leadership, is like, those are the guys that are going to produce the wins. They're the ones who are competing every day, and they have to feel like this is their team and this is their program. And you have to let them lead and you have to be okay with that. You can herd them, you can equip them with the tools. And that's, you know, I think how we've been able to develop some pretty strong leaders in our program.
How does that play into the off season, where, as everyone knows, in Division III, you don't have the same access to your players that you have in Division I? Clearly, you guys are going to get the 8 days. So I'm sure you got a lot of plans for those 8 days that you're going to be able to put together and be with your guys. But having strong leadership to be able to, just again, as you said, because guys are taking ownership in the program, they're doing the things that they need to do. But just talk a little bit about how player leadership influences the growth that your program has in the offseason.
Yeah, I mean, it's been everything. I'd even take it back to, so during that COVID year, you know, we brought everybody back to campus, and then we de-densified campus to where we only had freshmen on campus. So our upperclassmen had to go home. That second semester, they were going to bring upperclassmen back. Freshmen weren't invited back. But my guys all wanted to take a gap year so they could play 4 years of college basketball. So what our guys did was they ended up getting a house together in Charleston, South Carolina, that worked at a pizza shop. I don't know if anyone should ever order pizza from them, but but I was just like amazed that, like, you want to talk about growth in the offseason, right? Like, we just won 6 games, then we won 12, then we had COVID. So we doubled our wins. Those guys took it on themselves to say, hey, like, we're not having a year, but we have to continue to grow. We have to continue to get better. And the only way we're going to do that is if we are together. So almost half of our team was in Charleston, South Carolina, working at this pizza shop, working out, playing hoops. You know, some were taking some classes, but I think it was at that moment that I was like, man, our program's on the right track. If our guys care enough about each other to want to do something like this, I thought it was pretty cool. We had these awesome Zoom calls, you know, once a week, just like these check-ins. But again, like, when your guys are all together, it's way easier. And then that year we really started to take off. We had another new recruiting class. We were really young. But I thought some of our older guys really set the tone. And, you know, I give them a lot of freedom with that. You know, I ask them a lot of questions about, all right, what do you guys think, you know, is the appropriate amount of time to play pickup? You know, and they, you know, give me a response back. And I said, do you think that's good enough to win a national championship? Same thing. You know, this is what we're thinking about doing for lifts and cardio. Do you think this is good enough to win a national championship? And I want to know what their answer is. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, our ideas were on the same page. Sometimes we're a little off, and that's natural. And it allows us to have a little bit of discourse and figure it out. But I think you have to give those guys some freedom, especially, you know, at our level when we really can't be around them. But I think when you have the right team and you got have the right guys with the right mentality, I think it's they're going to get the job done.
When you think about where you are right now in this moment, and you think about your ideal vision for where you want this program to get to, what do you think is the biggest step, the biggest challenge, the biggest thing that you need to accomplish in order to be able to get to where you want to go?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. We actually, you know, in our end of season meeting, you know, we talked about that with our guys because, you know, we're so close. I mean, we had a, you know, a really good year again. We won 16 games. We beat Swarthmore, who ended up going to the Final Four this year. We actually held them to zero assists for the first time in their school history. And, you know, we competed with Mount Union, who went to a Final Four, put together 30 great minutes. You know, I think part of it is we're young. We were still playing a lot of underclassmen. So to be able to have just that experience of college basketball games in those moments. And, you know, I think we're, you know, I'm excited about that, play some upperclassmen this year. but, you know, when I think back to, you know, what we talked about of, all right, like, here we are. We finished third place back-to-back years. We've lost to Swarthmore in the conference semifinals back-to-back years. How are we going to crack through, and how are we really going to take this thing to the next level? We talked a lot about our mentality, that, you know, in game, I think with some, just when you have younger teams, you know, I think there's an opportunity, you know, there's times where things might not be going well, where guys could get a little frustrated and they could show that. I thought we do a really good job, I would say 90% of the time, but if we really want to compete on national level, like, we have to turn that thing on those 10% of the time. To get to 100. You know, we talk a lot about just our shooting has to improve. I think that's a big thing for us. You know, we had a lot of games where we were scoring 70s and 80s. We shot 30% from three. That's just not good enough, you know, for us to really compete at the next level. So, you know, that was a thing that, you know, we really wanted to improve in this offseason. We purchased the NOAA shooting system, which is, you know, the video camera on both hoops that, you know, provides our guys, you know, direct feedback, immediate feedback.
So how do you use the NOAA? I'm just curious, just in your program, because I mean, I think it's a really cool piece of technology. Yeah. I'm just curious how you put it to use.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of it is like in the off season, you know, our guys can just go in and use it on their own. You know, I can't really look at it or track it, right? Because, you know, it's the off season, but, right. You know, our guys, you know, raved about it and thought it provided the right feedback and allowed them to really recognize why they were making shots or why they're missing shots. I'm excited to use it, you know, with guys in workouts, especially there's one feature called the splash, which it will only make a splash noise if it's within like 2 or 3 degrees in the metrics. So it really forces guys to put an emphasis on their mechanics for each shot, right? So we're excited to use that. And I just think that direct feedback, you know, I think that guys need every now and then, just like, all right, that arc, it was 42. The goal is 45, right? Like, you need to hear that to recognize, all right, I got to get my elbow up, or, man, I was off, you know, left or right. Like, my wrist wasn't, you know, centered. You know, my depth, I was short. Like, I got to reach a little more into the hoop, right? So, you know, we're really excited to add that. But I think that was just another element for us. It's like, we really have to improve our three-point shooting. Swarthmore and Hopkins are such great three-point shooting teams. And then, you know, we talked about just – you know, continuing to grow and develop our role and our, you know, our bench production. I think, you know, we have a lot of really talented players on the team, and, you know, we need to make sure that, you know, we can get more out of that group. But I think those three things are kind of where we need to go. And I think our culture is really strong. We have the right pieces. I think we just have to fine tune those three things. And I think we're really excited for what we could possibly do this next season.
Not, I didn't hear you mention milk crates.
you know, that could come out, man. That could come out. You know, we actually, when milk crates are used with the, you know, 45-pound plates and our guys, you know, push them up and down the court.
You're missing out on the marketing, man. Forget the Noah. Just you should start selling the BJ Dunn milk crates.
Seriously.
All right. One final question. When you think about what you get to do every single day, wake up in the morning and you get to go to your job, what brings you the most joy being the head coach at Gettysburg College?
You know, I think there's two things. One, I love coaching. You get to watch your players, you know, go through some really hard things and embrace adversity and come out on the other side and win. And it brings me a lot of joy to see them succeed and on and off the court. You know, I think for me, you know, we have a 2.5-year-old. It's my wife's alma mater. I get to drop him off every day on campus at daycare. He loves my guys. My guys love him. It was actually really cool. I was checking in with all my guys yesterday, and every single one of them asked about him. That was pretty next level. And then I get to go into a gym where, you know, my wife has banners that hang. So I think the combination of, you know, watching your guys succeed and push through and win in life, and then, you know, to be at a place that means a lot to your family, and then to watch your little guy, you know, grow up and celebrate with the guys and dance in the locker room. And I think the impact that they, you know, get to make on his life, whether they know it or not, is pretty cool. Like, you know, he was at graduation cheering for those guys. I mean, he's 2.5 years old. He knows everybody's name, and he's watching them come across the stage and he's rooting them on. I just think they've made such an impact in his life. And it's a pretty cool, you know, thing for me and my wife to experience.
Absolutely. To be able to have your basketball family interconnect with your real family, I think is something that is really special. And it's obviously something that as he continues to grow up and being around the guys, and just going to make it from a father-son perspective and a family perspective, just such a joy to be able to have that. So I think that's well said. Before we wrap up, I want to give you a chance to share how people can connect with you, learn more about your program. You want to share a website, social media, email, whatever you feel comfortable with. And then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I'm pretty active on Twitter, my personal. I got to remember it here. I think it's Coach BJ Dunn. We're at GBergMBB for both Twitter and Instagram. Always trying to post content and, you know, promote our guys and what we're trying to do. And, you know, always want to help just the younger generation of coaches and, you know, the best that I can. So never hesitate to reach out. I've been really fortunate to be mentored by some great, you know, coaches who've provided me some incredible experiences and opened a ton of doors, and, you know, love to pay it forward.
BJ, cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule tonight to join us. Really appreciate it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.